watched you in action around Canberra over several years now, and I've also now read some of your academic writing. And it seems to me that there are two values that consistently find expression in your work. The first is curiosity, and the second is intellectual rigour. So I'd like to ask you, what do those two values mean to you in your day-to-day work?
Great question. Well, first of all, thanks, Janet, for the most generous introduction I've ever received. People have said nice things about me, but no one has ever ranked me above the Prime Minister. So thank you for that. And thanks, everyone, for being here at the end of a very long day. A PhD is enough to make your head explode, but a day of talking about one might be just as taxing. So I really appreciate you sticking around. I think the importance of curiosity just can't be underestimated. One of the most useful pieces of life advice, I think, for anyone starting out is to think about finding something that you love that not many other people love. There are, if you're talking, for example, to a group of high schoolers, there are many people that love the idea that they might make their way as a star basketballer or as a star musician. The problem is there's lots of other people that love those things. So the challenge for a high schooler is to identify something that they really enjoy that not a lot of other people enjoy, whether that's marine biology or statistics or engineering or understanding Greek ruins. And I think the same thing applies to PhDs. You're all into them, so your ability to... Who is yet to choose a topic? Is anyone... No, so you have... So really it's not particularly useful for me to tell you that if you're not curious and engaged in your topic at the start, then the end will be much tougher. Because let's face it, everybody hates their PhD topic by the end.
Andrew, as an economist, you have written about the return to education at different levels of qualification. So I want to ask you what might seem a deceptively simple question. What is the value of a PhD?
So in wage terms, we have this sort of standard thing in economics of education, where each additional year of education boosts your earnings by about 8 to 10%. And that holds pretty much through the distribution when you're going through finishing school or going to university or doing a master's. It turns out to flatten out a little for doing a PhD. The earnings of those with PhDs are higher than the earnings of those with master's degrees, but not quite sort of 8 to 10% a year more. The value, I think, is in learning to think and learning to think rigorously. I now have 5 permanent staff in my office, and turns out 3 of them have PhDs. So I think ours is the most over-educated office in Parliament House. And I was joking to one of the 2 staff that doesn't have a PhD the other day that we'd better start talking about topics. But that ability to go deeply into one thing, I think, helps you understand a wide range of other topics. Helps you to understand how to think about other topics. It makes you realise how complex a single topic is, and therefore the ability to take those skills to other areas. The opportunity to teach also shouldn't be underestimated. What share of you are doing some teaching, by the way? And some work as research assistants for academics? So both of those are just enormously valuable. And certainly in the course of my PhD, I learned at least as much from working as a research assistant with a good academic and working as a teaching fellow, for those who are thinking about academic careers, that's enormously important. But even for those who are not thinking about academic careers, I think that side of the PhD matters a lot for rounding out your rigorous thinking.
I might throw to the audience, if that's okay,
sure.
to if anyone has a follow-up question on that topic of what's the value of the PhD, and Andrew, you've answered that largely in the frame of the value to the PhD holder. There might be other aspects of the question that people want to follow up, or that same one again. Does anyone...
Yeah. Can I follow on this idea that learning to think with rigour is an important part of the when I watch some politicians who shove them in neighbors, it seems that they haven't learned that. And I'm wondering if that's because they did not go through a research experience as a PhD student or elsewhere, or is it just the fact that students back in the day did not have to think as rigorously as other students?
So there is a view that you occasionally see in politics that all evidence is manufactured to suit the priors of the person doing the research, that a study can be produced which will show that smoking causes cancer or that smoking doesn't cause cancer. And I fundamentally disagree with that kind of pure relativist view of the world. And I think once you get into research on a certain discipline, you come to understand how that discipline works, and that sort of attitude frustrates you enormously. But politics is also the art of trying to communicate ideas into the lives of extremely busy people. So in a world in which you're trying to have your say about climate change to a population that are, you know, watching fabulous movies, raising wonderful kids, enjoying fantastic music and art, you only have a small amount of someone's day. So you can't necessarily go into all of the nuances of climate change in order to insert yourself into that person's life and to have a... because you only get a little snippet of political conversation. I should, of course, have said that there's a community benefit to doing a PhD. There are social returns to education. Those social returns kind of differ across the distribution. So if you're talking about the social returns to finishing high school, a lot of that is on decreased welfare use and decreased crime. Going and doing a PhD doesn't have those sort of social returns, but its main social returns come through the productivity of co-workers. So those who work around you will benefit from you having your PhD, because you'll introduce them into new ways of thinking. So there's those positive spillovers, which of course is why society should be and is contributing to part of the cost of your education. And we can there's a bigger and deeper conversation about the share of your education society should subsidise.
Does anyone want to go into that conversation right now?
Probably, so, like, the social returns are pretty hard to measure, and so this is a little bit more of an art than a science.
Let me ask you then a question that's sort of along the same lines, but a little bit different. For a lot of today, we've been talking about, you know, what can a PhD do for us, and what can we do with our PhD in a career. But I think most of us would agree that it's, and some of the panelists have highlighted, that it's an enormous privilege to have the opportunity of obtaining this higher level of qualification. And so I wanted to ask you, what, if any, obligation do you feel that privilege might carry with it?
I think there is an obligation to use your training for good rather than for evil, to make sure that you're encouraging others around you in their work. And, you know, I noticed very much as a junior academic that the sort of work that I was doing with PhD students, sometimes those collaborations were a net positive, but sometimes they were more in the nature of a transfer, of me working a little bit more slowly on a project than I would have been able to on my own, but helping that PhD student recognise what it was to do a rigorous piece of research. And so that obligation to sort of keep on giving back to the system, I think, is pretty important. Because it's really only through doing a rigorous piece of research that you get a sense as to what it's like.
Thank you. Does anyone have a follow-up question on that topic? Everybody's rather tired, Andrew, because we've been here all day.
Understandably, yes.
And you are too, because you've just come from Brisbane just during the day and landed here and suddenly had to show up.
So. No, it's great. It's great. Though I did come from a city whose... minimum temperature today is 5 degrees higher than the maximum temperature in Canada.
Well, that must be nice.
Yeah, there's a guy on the plane with shorts who is not looking at me.
I've got a question then. Uh-oh. So I've noticed with Adam and with yourself, Andrew, that you answer very quickly compared to some of our other speakers. You've mastered the art of talking precisely. Is there anything that you did to foster that skill? Did it just happen as you were in that world of politics?
Everything in life is about practice, right? So, in general, the first speech you give will be awful, and the 2,000th speech you give will be good. And I think that's also true for playing the violin or writing an opinion piece. So, practicing things that are hard is important. And that's particularly important for things you want to be good at, but you don't really like doing. Like a job interview. So how many of you have done less than 5 job interviews in your life? Yeah, right. So you should not make your next job interview the one that you really care about. You should make your next job interview either a mock job interview with a couple of your friends or some friendly academics, or... and I'll deny having said this if you quote it back to me, apply for a job you don't want and use that opportunity to practice your interviewing skills. Because let's face it, putting on a good interview is a really important thing to do, and I've seen people who look great on paper crash and burn in important academic job interviews and be beaten by candidates who were not as good on paper but just... delivered a cracker job interview. So practice, practice, practice.
I might continue on that line then.
Sure.
So you've obviously sat on a lot of selection panels for academics. I've been doing a little bit of that myself lately, and it's quite an interesting experience with yourself on the other side of it. What are the things that you think people should do in job interviews that really make that difference in academia?
So if you're talking about a kind of level B position, you want a bit of teaching, but then mostly just a passion for research, a sense of curiosity, a sense that the person isn't just the kind of person who wants to show up in the morning and do research because that's in their title. It's that they live and breathe it. It's that when they... go to bed at night, they've got new ideas swirling around their heads. When they wake up in the morning, they really want to get to the computer and type some stuff down. You know, when they're on the toilet, they're thinking about their research. And when they have coffee, they don't want to. They're not going to sit down and say, "Well, I'm glad I've stopped my research. Now let's talk about the footy." But they're actually going to bring their ideas into that conversation. And so that sense of the passion for research really matters at a kind of level B, BC interview. If you're doing a DE, then, again, you're looking for some track record on teaching, track record on research, and a sense of mentorship, that the person knows what it is to work with colleagues in an academic unit, that they can troubleshoot staff problems, and that they have a sense of vision as to the sort of cohesive group they want to build. You can't get a job as a professor without those sort of without some vision as to where you want that set, that part of the university to go.
Thank you. I might steer the conversation back to your parliamentary
sure.
role a little. We can still talk about the academic stuff. How many people actually are contemplating an academic career? This might have been asked earlier in the day. Mm. Yeah, so quite a few. So there is some value in discussing that further. But I wonder, we heard from Adam Bant earlier in the day at some length, and he was talking in a very interesting way about the connection between his PhD and his participation in public life. And I wonder if you could expand on what is for you the connection between those two things.
Yeah, so I mean, bits of my PhD, I guess I've kind of drawn on later, but it was essentially the grounding for then the kind of 50, 60 papers that I wrote as an academic. So I don't draw that much on the thesis. I draw more on my time as an academic. And I suppose the way I think of politics is that it's the confluence of power and ideas. So it's got a little bit of Arthur, a little bit of Merlin, and I'm probably more on the kind of Merlin end than the Arthur end. So the role that I see for a professor turned politician is to continue writing. So I just this week brought out the third book that I've done since I went into Parliament, and you know, I write a couple of academic articles a year, typically now with co-authors rather than solo, but also to be a conduit to academics. So to be very receptive to academic research, to be taking academic studies and putting them in front of colleagues, to be providing opportunities for academics to be in the room with policy makers. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late great US senator, senator for New York for the best part of a generation and formerly a Harvard professor, used to organise dinner parties in Washington, D.C., where he would try and mix academics and politicians. And that seems to be something that's worth doing and a role I want to play. Yeah.
So that's one of the things that you love and are into, that not everybody who's in politics...
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's comparative advantage again, right? So if you're a truck driver turned politician, then you should stay in touch with the people who used to drive trucks with. In fact, you should probably keep your truck licence, because that means that then when we're discussing how best to reduce the road toll, you're entirely in touch with that community and you can bring those ideas into Parliament. And the same thing holds for an academic turned politician.
Let me ask you the same question twice in the context of your academic and your parliamentary careers. If someone in this room was contemplating following a path into public life or following a path into academia, what questions should that person be asking themselves and others around them?
Do I love this more than anything else? I'm not sure the people around you can give you much insight onto this. Mm-hmm. Except maybe they can tell you whether you look like you're loving it. But surely surely that matters in terms of, you know, if we're choosing any career. Academia is easier to plan. Politics is highly random. In fact, I'm working on a bit of a project on luck and politics. And so no one should kind of plan their life with the intention of ending up in elected office, only because the odds of ending up in elected office for any individual are fairly small, and you don't want to kind of end... You don't want to be eternally frustrated. But certainly, if you're interested in politics, you should leave that option open. Join a political party, go along to its meetings, stay engaged in political issues, and be there if the opportunity arises. You know, if the bus pulls up and you happen to be at the bus stop, then you want to be at the bus stop. But you also want to kind of have a good book to read at the bus stop, because there might not be a bus along.
And so you would say the same key question for both of the two careers that you've sampled in depth.
Yeah, don't do things you hate in order to get things you like, because generally you will end up disgruntled and you'll do a bad job of them.
Nice. So that question about what questions should we ask is one that I've heard suggested when people are going networking or looking for career guidance or advice on careers. So rather than asking, what have you done and how can I get there, you ask, from your experience, how can you distill that into some questions that I could be asking for myself now?
Yeah.
So that's only one question. Are there any other questions that are worth asking at the outset of a career?
Sure. How narrow or broad should you be in your research agenda was one that came up a lot for me. And it took me a long time as a young academic to sort this out. The constant advice I would get from senior people is there are high returns to specialisation. You will become an expert in a particular area. You'll know all of the data and the theory. You will know all the people who will end up refereeing your papers, and you will be highly successful. But the trouble is, I never really enjoyed working on exactly the same things month after month. I wanted a plethora of projects to work on. And it's sort of embarrassing to admit, it took me about 3 years to realise that my academic productivity wasn't the only thing I was trying to maximise. I was also trying to live a life that I enjoyed. And so... work on the stuff that makes you happy. For me, that was a diversified bunch of things. For other people, it's a narrow set of things. But don't be too guided by people who tell you you must shape your academic career like this, even if it makes you miserable. Life's too short.
Is there any analogous kind of decision in politics about breadth and narrowness?
Yeah, I guess so. So politics is a sort of unusual occupation in that the number of professors at ANU is not a fixed number. So if the Vice Chancellor thinks someone should be promoted to professor, then they can. But politics, a bit like sporting teams, has fixed numbers of people in certain roles. So you only become a minister. So imagine you're a Liberal Party backbencher. The only way of becoming a minister is for another minister to step down. So that generates competition, which can sometimes be a little unhealthy. And I think one of the challenges in politics is for people to just enjoy what they're doing rather than worry too much about where they are on the greasy pole.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a more broadly applicable sentiment too.
Yeah, but particularly for kind of zero-sum workplaces. So I guess I'd give the same advice to people who are trying to make the first 11.
So we have only a few minutes left. Does anybody have a question? Yes.
Hello, Andrew. I'm G'day. Delighted to have come up from Melbourne today, especially to come and hear you speak in the flesh. I've read all of your books.
Uh-oh.
I'm a huge fan.
Wow, thank you.
And I'd like to see you as our Treasurer or Prime Minister one day, so hopefully I'm very optimistic that you talk a lot about equality, and that's something that I'm passionate about as well. I live in a very safe Liberal seat. I'd like to know perhaps what I can do. I don't agree with a lot of the policies of the government at this time. What can you do when you live in a safe Liberal seat to, I guess, promote more of the values of the Labour Party or the Greens or other political groups?
Yeah, so getting involved in the local bits of your party, whether... You know, it sounds like maybe it's the Labor Party in your case, but the same advice would apply for the Liberal National Greens Party, is worthwhile and participating in those conversations. The party is, certainly my political party, but I suspect this will happen to others as well, is going through a stage of wanting to bring a whole lot more members in, democratise the process and beef up the role of ideas. So it's a good time to be engaged in political parties at the moment, because they're going through, much as the news media is kind of going through a pretty big seismic shock, the same thing's happening to political parties at the moment. But happy to have a longer conversation with you around specifics of Victorian Labor, if that's useful.
We have time for a couple more questions. Let me throw it here, yes.
So the whole session, I've been looking for a specific suggestion for, as an international student, so I've been looking for something special for international PhD student.
Yeah.
So nobody actually mentioned about anything specific for international students. So what your suggestion to think about a career being an international student, because we came from a very different country and we don't have any already developed network. So we started to develop our network, and it's pretty slow nowadays. So what's your specific suggestion for?
Do you want to work in Australia or another country?
In Australia.
Yeah. So I suppose I've always been a bit sceptical of networking for its own sake. My general view is you should be nice to people and work hard on the stuff you care about. But you don't need to run around kind of befriending people who do work that's entirely unrelated. Academia is not a perfect meritocracy, but it's closer to a meritocracy than many other professions in Australia. So I would focus on the research that you enjoy, about getting publications in good places. Seek advice from people who you particularly admire, but don't feel that you have to spend your life networking. One of the kind of nice things about academia, it struck me this week. I've been going to various universities to launch my book, and I'm reminded that there are some wonderfully introverted and slightly socially awkward people who are among our best Australian academics. And it just speaks to the fact that, you know, those people have gotten to where they are because networking is not a core requirement of being a great academic. That's just it's a really nice thing about the profession, though. Does anyone trust introverts more than extroverts? Just curious.
How do you define yourself as an introvert or extrovert?
Probably an extrovert, is that bad?
Now that you've asked the question, trust.
Thanks for coming to bubble that.
There are two questions over here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm an introvert. similar to what Adam Band was discussing earlier, I'm just wondering how you approach people in your working life who don't really understand how to evaluate and appreciate evidence like we're trying to do in a research.
So one of the issues that's been coming out this week is the expansion of Work for the Dole. Work for the Dole sounds like a great program. We have people who are unemployed and we make them go and do jobs and then they get skills and then they get real jobs. Just turns out that when Jeff Borland and Yiping Seng evaluated a version of Work for the Dole a decade or so ago, they found that it increased joblessness rather than decreasing joblessness. So I tend to just talk about it in exactly those terms. To accept the, first of all, to resonate with the Work for the Dole advocates' core sense that this is a good program, but then also to reflect back that we need to turn to expert advice. That doesn't work for everyone, though. One of the things I really noticed during the climate change debate is initially I would say things like, 95% of the world's scientists believe the world is warming and humans are causing it. And then midway through that, we had the same-sex marriage debate, where a group of various religious leaders in my community would come to me and say, same-sex marriage is bad because the Bible says so. They would essentially make an argument by appeal to authority. And that wasn't particularly persuasive for me, and it made me think, oh, well, maybe my appeals to authority in the area of climate change aren't very persuasive to other people. So then I started talking less about what all the scientists believe, appealing to the experts, and more kind of simply characterising the facts. Every decade since the 1940s has been warmer than the one before it. 13 of the 14 hottest years on record have been in the last two decades. So to the extent that you can simplify down the facts, I think that's kind of useful in public communication. But occasionally, it's hard to do much else than appeal to authority.